This is the Waters and Harvey Show. I'm Darren Waters.
And I'm Marcus Harvey.
The Asheville YWCA is celebrating its 110th anniversary this year. What has the YWCA been doing to meet its mission, and what are its plans for the future? We're going to explore these questions today on our show. Back in a moment. Again, this is the Waters and Harvey Show. I'm Darren Waters. And as always, I'm very, very happy and very pleased to be here with my brother and co-host, Dr. Marcus Harvey. Marcus, how is the world treating you?
Fairly nice. How about you?
Pretty good. I am looking forward to this conversation today to talk about the YWCA and 110 years. That's a long, long history. And I'm interested in finding out what they've been doing to meet their mission, which has been, you know, eliminating racism and empowering women. So this should be an interesting conversation today. I have done work on social organizations like this, even in my own research, looking at the YMCA and its work, which was founded in the 1940s in London, England. I know shortly after the YMCA was founded, the YWCA was also founded in London, England. And so it's a very interesting and rich history that the YWCA has.
Yeah, and what's interesting is that many people aren't necessarily aware of the really pivotal role that the organizations like the YWCA have played in social movements. And also it's important to note that even though the YWCA is founded in, 1907, the actual organizational work spans back to right before the Civil War.
Right.
So this is really an organization that has a deep history in this country.
And very important to the city and to this region. Mm-hmm. And I think about the fact I was looking at some of the history of the YWCA, the larger organization itself, and found out it has a presence in 120 countries around the world. I mean, so this is a very important organization. And I know through conversations that I've had with colleagues here in the city that the YWCA here in Asheville has played an important role in social change right here in Asheville.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also, I think, it's important to note that the year that the YWCA is founded, 1907, right? So this is once Jim Crow was underway. I mean, so really think about the courage that it took to organize, especially as a women's organization in the midst of such a hostile social environment.
Right. So we didn't want to take up too much time, you know, going back and forth as we usually do, talking about topics like this, because we have two very special guests here with us in the studio today, and we want to get back to them and get into the conversation to talk about the YWCA's work here as soon as possible. So if you all would stay with us, we'll be back in just a moment. Again, this is you're listening to the Waters and Harvey Show. It's good to be back with you again. And we really appreciate you all staying in tune and listening to what I believe is a very important conversation about the YWCA, the local YWCA. And we're very pleased and very proud to have two guests here in the studio with us today. We have YWCA CEO, Ms. Beth Maska. And we also have my colleague, who it's great to have another historian here in the studio with us, and she'll probably find out that I end up trying to make everybody a historian in every conversation.
Well, I'm an honorary one, right?
That's right. But I am very proud and pleased to finally have in here with us Dr. Sarah Judson, who is an associate professor of history at UNC Asheville. Marcus and I want to welcome you both to the studio.
Welcome both
thank
of you.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Thank you all for joining us. Well, Beth, we want to start with you. I mean, CEO of the YWCA. Just give us a little bit of history about your background. How did you come to the YMCA, and how long have you been there?
I've been at the YWCA for five years now, but I've been in Asheville for coming on 29.
So. Well, did I mess that up?
Yeah.
Okay, so, you know, I need to apologize to Beth. I said, you know, again, I knew that I was going to end up messing that up, but the YWCA. So tell us again. So sorry for interrupting you.
Well, I've been here 5 years, and I'm really proud of the work that we're doing. We do direct service work in three main areas of nurturing children, promoting health, and empowering women. But undergirding all of that work is our advocacy and our work on eliminating racism.
Right. Yeah.
And that has happened historically as well.
Yeah, and as we alluded to earlier, Beth, the YWCA has a long tradition of working around issues of racial and economic justice. How is that work continuing in 2017?
Well, most recently, I will say after Ferguson, a number of nonprofits that focused on racial justice came together, and really at the calling of Pastor James Lee, who wanted to work with the churches and the nonprofits together. And we wanted to prevent any violence that was happening in other places in the country. And we came together and came up with a focus of looking at best practices in policing and focusing on community policing, had a community dialogue that was hosted at the YMI Cultural Center two summers ago and right when the new chief was coming on. And we've been in conversations with the chief throughout, and after last summer's shooting, we were already talking about what are some of the best practices and policies we can put in place here in Asheville to prevent violence. And we are proud to have worked with the police department in being part of the community process. There was about 16 organizations, mm-hmm. five of them were members of the Racial Justice Coalition, including the NAACP and the Asheville Housing Authority, Black Lives Matter, as well as myself and other leaders in the community. So we felt like for our community to be proactively bringing in the voices of the community to those policies, we now have the strongest use of force policies focusing on de-escalation in the state. Our chief has been invited to speak in South Carolina. The chief of police is in South Carolina. We're looking at Asheville's model of community involvement to replicate. And we are in a small percentage of communities that are proactively putting in stronger, much stronger use of force policies. And so things like you cannot shoot someone from behind, you cannot shoot at a moving car, things that had been allowed are no longer allowed. And as of the end of April, all of our officers are trained in these new policies.
Well, right. Remarkable.
Yeah, and it sounds like you all have kind of been on the cutting edge of so much of this. What accounts for that? I mean, what has made it so unique here that you're having these conversations, you're being proactive about these conversations in Asheville, if that makes sense?
Well, you know, I think from the very roots of the YWCA, and Sarah knows a lot about this as well, but when the YWCA started, it was a boarding house to allow women to come into the city to work, and they needed chaperoned housing. And this happened all over the country, mostly in the East Coast. But as these women were living together, they started to advocate on public policies like the 8-hour workday and child labor laws. And so from the very roots, advocacy has been at the core of the YWCA. And we hold that up as really important because it's really the difference between charity and justice. Right. We're not just providing services. We're trying to address the underlying issues of why people are poor. And I believe two of the main reasons people are poor are poverty or racism and sexism.
Right. And so that brings me, you're talking about racism. You have every year, I think annually, Stand Against Racism.
That's right.
This program. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
So that has, I think we've just celebrated our 10th year. And nationally, communities come together and they and organizations within a community will choose how they do their stand. In Asheville, we've always been one of the largest participants. I think we had over 50 organizations throughout the city have individual or public stands. So, for example, a business could read an article like Unpacking the Invisible Backpack of White Privilege mm-hmm. and have a discussion among their coworkers, and that would be a private stand. And then there's very public stands like forums and marches. The Isaac Dixon students often march. There's often movie viewings. Francine Delaney's viewed the movie 13th mm-hmm. and had a community discussion about that. But 50 events like that happened right. throughout the month of April. And we hosted a forum at the Wesley Grant Center of Women of Color Leading Change right. and had four young emerging leaders share their voices of the work and the challenges they have.
Oh, good. Yeah, and just kind of spinning off of it, but I'm curious to know, I'm a fairly recent transplant in Asheville. Has there been really any resistance to the Stand Against Racism project as an annual event, or have you found that that there's quite a bit of receptivity to Stand Against Racism in this area?
I think it's been really embraced very strongly, and some initiatives have just taken on a life of their own. And for example, the Diversity Engagement Coalition started out of a Stand Against Racism at UNC Asheville 4 years ago, and they brought in a Harvard professor who focused, and I don't remember his name, but he focused on disparities in hiring and just the difference of names on resumes would be the same credentials. Well, he brought in office studies around that, and the audience was HR professionals. And then afterwards, they created the Diversity Engagement Coalition so that the largest employers in our community are working together to recruit and promote and retain people of color in the workforce. And so that has just taken off in ways that we could have never even imagined.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Yeah, you're raising so many different avenues through which we can go down to talk about, so we could be here for a while. But what we want to talk to you about is also, Beth, is 110 years. Again, this is a long history. So what are you all doing to commemorate that and celebrate that this year?
Well, we were very proud to partner with UNC Asheville, both Dr. Judson's history class and the Ramsey Library Archives. And we had a celebration recently that highlighted first of all, the archive project. We received a box of 400 photographs that had been held at the YMI Cultural Center. And a board member there, Sasa Mitchell, realized they were our archives and returned them to us with the desire that they be available to the community. And with that challenge, we started this spring having community viewing days. And through an intern, Catherine Eichner scanned and made paper copies of all these pictures, and then we invited people to come into our multi-purpose room at the YWCA and identify people and let us know what was happening. And I mean, that was the beginning. And I'll let Sarah talk a little bit about what we did with her class.
Right, and so that's what we want to bring Sarah in here to talk about this oral history project, Sarah. Again, welcome to the show. It's good to have you here. Let's talk about this oral history project. You know, we hear from Beth how it developed. You ran with this and did it as a class, right? So can you tell us a little bit about some of the parameters of the project?
Yeah, I'd be so happy to. It was such a great experience. So the class was African American history since 1865, and I had 16 students in the class. And the project that we developed was to create a website for the Asheville YWCA. And on the website, we had interviews that students did with community members, staff, and volunteers. The students made digital timelines of each interviewee's life, so you could see the context of their life experience. In national history or in Asheville history. The audio is uploaded to the website, and then each pair of students wrote an essay contextualizing the life of the interviewee in national history.
Well, so, see, Sarah,
it's pretty cool.
This sounds like a fascinating project. Is the website still available?
Linked to the YWCA's website under our if you look for history, and there's the project right there, and the archives as well.
I'm sure that's going to drive a lot of people to the website to view this. And one thing I'm curious about is I'm listening to Sarah talk about this digital project, and she knows that I have resisted the whole digital history.
Me too, man.
Get with it.
But it worked. It worked. It really was good.
And I'm sitting here listening to Sarah. I'm thinking, I thought I had a partner in this resistance to this new technology. It sounds like she's mastered it. So this is great.
And Sarah, my question would be, what were participants in the Oral History Project? Were they, did students encounter difficulty getting people to, share their experience, to share stories in order to build this project? Or did they experience something that was, less conflictual in that respect?
Yeah. That's a very good question. And I think that oral history is such a kind of delicate experience because it relies on trust and it relies on the ability of the person doing the interview to kind of take themselves out and put the focus on the interviewee. So it's not something that is easily done. I think that the majority of the students had they all had a positive experience. And interviewees were, on the most part, very forthcoming. People did not divulge their deepest, darkest secrets, but we would not expect that because of the period of time. You know, the students met with the interviewees for an hour. And so, but the rich material that came out of these interviews really, really remarkable. Like, just to tell you one thing, there was a woman who was interviewed who was very galvanized by the Cold War and wanted...
Dolores Workman.
Yeah, Dolores Workman. And she contacted President Kennedy about helping citizens get access to air raid shelters during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And later in life, she realized that this project, as great as it was kind of fraught because of Jim Crow segregation and what would have happened to African-American residents of Asheville if there had been a nuclear bomb dropped and they could not get on the buses.
Wow.
So she talked about that, that experience and also that realization. So it was a very rich experience.
So the project really did uncover new information, things that we didn't know.
I think so.
Oh, yeah. And see, this is always good. Now, you named one of the participants, one of the interviewees in the project. Who were some of the others? I know that Miss Lydia Childs
was
one
of them,
who's the president of the YWCA's board, right?
Correct.
And, you know, we were hoping that she would be able to join us for this interview, but that didn't happen. But she was one of the people who participated as well. Can you tell us a little bit, about some of the things that came out of those interviews?
Well, that was a wonderful interview, and Ms. Childs had a great time. The interviewees had a great time, so that was really successful. And her story was just remarkable. She talked about how her parents had really infused in her and encouraged in her a strong sense of social justice. She had been there were regular attendees of the Hill Street Baptist Church, and that was a real kind of community-based activist orientation of the church had that. And through her mother, she was introduced to civil rights protest and nonviolent protests. She marched with her mother in front of Winn-Dixie to protest racist hiring, the commitment by Winn-Dixie to not hire people of color. And that was part of an ACE score protest. And so as a young child, she, when it was part of that, she had a lot to tell us. It was a great interview.
Yeah. And actually, the YW's Public Affairs Committee was part of that, too.
Absolutely.
Oh, nice. It was all connected.
Nice. Oh, nice. Really? It really was.
Yeah. Helping with that effort. Mm-hmm.
And all supporting the ACE score students,
from the very beginning.
Beginning.
It's a fascinating, in general, just looking at the field of women's history is a very interesting history. Mm-hmm. And the commitment from the very beginning to issues of social justice is just there, whereas other communities have had to be dragged into this, kind of kicking and screaming.
On various levels, grassroots and leadership levels.
And you can see here that it was early on.
Yeah.
Well, I would just like to say that is really true, and that the Asheville YWCA has really been on the front lines of uncovering injustice, protesting and struggling for justice, and creating a space in the city where people can come together and air grievances and talk about different issues and develop grassroots community-based leadership. And I think that is unique here in Asheville. You don't see that, in my view, in the history of the city. I wouldn't want to say it's unique in North Carolina, but it has held a very special role in promoting the voices of people of the city. And so I think that cannot be underestimated, the pivotal role that the YWCA has played in really challenging inequality and injustice here in Asheville.
Yeah. And Sarah, another participant-related question. Did you note that participants commented on how sort of things have changed in the city over time or not? And sort of to append a second question to that question, if I might. If changes were noted, did participants attribute some or all of those changes to the YWCA's work?
I feel like I cannot answer that question in the way that you and the audience might want me to, because the stories in some ways were personal.
Okay.
But some people did comment on how things are worse now than they've ever been.
Worse now?
Yes.
Interesting.
And they were referring to our national political climate as well as, the local political climate, gentrification. Economic inequality, lack of opportunity. As we know, the opportunities for people of color in the city have become less and less as it becomes more and more oriented towards development. Sorry, I should probably stop talking right now.
I will say that they the theme was that so many of them grew up in the YWCA. They were involved with YWCA students, and now they're volunteering as foster grandmothers and helping the children in our early learning program. So that was a theme of why they were interviewed.
Yeah, and I think that's such a good point. And I'm glad that you said that, Beth, because I was starting to get off on a soapbox here. But I think that is the beauty of oral history as a method, because we're so used to talking about the forest, right? It's like the institution. And we don't often talk about the trees.
Right.
And we don't talk about the personal small stories of people that create the institution, who sustain the institution, whose resiliency impacts people on a daily level. So the foster grandparents and the work that they do has an impact far beyond what we see every day.
Right. Well, what I'd like to do here, Sarah, you've raised a number of questions, but one of the things that I wanted to do in having you here was also talk about your background. Now, you went to UNC Chapel Hill as an undergrad, right? And for graduate school, NYU, and studied. What can you tell us a little bit about your academic background, what you studied at NYU when you were there, what you worked on? Because now your work is really taking you, you're doing a lot of work on Asheville and the history here. And so we want to talk to you a few minutes about that as well, because I think some of it relates to what the YWCA has been doing.
Yeah. So, NYU. So when I was there, I was so fortunate to work with a historian named Robin Kelly, who is my favorite historian. And he is well-renowned in the field of United States history, as well as African-American history and history of music, 20th century U.S. music. And so that was a blessing to work with him. I began as a labor historian, though, I will say, and I was interested in Southern labor history, and I wrote my master's thesis on the Southern Tenant Farmers Union in Southeast Missouri, Northern Arkansas, and the Delta region. But then I became very interested in women's history, and I wrote my dissertation on African-American and white women's politics in Atlanta. And so I was very interested in how women's political engagement really helped build the city before they could vote or hold political office. And so I was interested in kind of grassroots community building and how that shaped urban politics. And so it is very related to the work that I do here, both on the Asheville YWCA, but also on other areas like the Hillcrest tenant strike and some work I'm doing now on the high school students walkout in 1969 at Asheville High.
Now tell us, if you don't mind, Sarah, just telling us a little bit about, because we can clearly see why it was a perfect connection for you to lead this project for the YWCA and the work that you've been doing on women's history and looking at grassroots politics. Now, some of your work has been published, and so I'd like for the audience to know about what are some of the things that you published, and where can they find some of this work, that you've done?
Thank you, Darren, for the plug. So I most recently published an article that's in the North Carolina History Review, and it's called "I Was a Nasty Branch Kid, Women's Memories of Urban Renewal in Asheville, North Carolina," and that is based on an oral history project that I was part of maybe 10 years ago, where some folks and I interviewed residents of the East End Valley Street neighborhood to learn more about the experience of urban renewal, and that's where that project came out of. That's the most recent work, and hoping to get more out there.
Well, I can tell you, it's been probably one of the joys of my career, my very young career, to work with Sarah on so many things, because my work is situated in the late 19th century, and Sarah is so much of an expert on the 20th century, so I've relied on you a lot for a lot of the more recent history that has taken place here. And I think that people have been amazed by what they did not know, what your work has uncovered. So it's very important work.
And I did not know that you worked with Professor Kelly at NYU. That is, because I use his work a lot in my own research.
Oh, he's such a
So hero. What would you say is the future of the YWCA? What should people be looking for in terms of future initiatives, programs, events, things of that sort?
Well, I'll say our biggest focus right now continues to be on providing childcare, because childcare is the biggest barrier to women's economic empowerment. And there's a crisis of childcare in our community, both birth to five and school age. So that's an area that we both provide services and do a lot of advocacy to right now in the General Assembly about how they're funding childcare. And I would say another big initiative, there's a big discrepancy in access to swimming for children of color, and children of color are more likely to drown, 6 times more likely to drown. And so we did a pilot with a middle school for after-school swim lessons, and we're hoping to expand that to PE classes for sixth graders in the future. So we're really trying to continue in all that we do to eliminate disparities, and that is a really critical one.
Well, Biff, one last question here. How can people get involved?
Well, the best way is to come visit us. We have regular tours on the first and third Tuesday at 11:30, our Empower Hour tours, and they can get an overview of our mission and our programs and get a light, nutritious lunch. We'd love to have visitors, and they can check out our programs on our website as well.
Well, great. It's been good to have you all here. Thank you all for coming joining us here
Thank
on
you.
The show. And I know that our listeners will be deeply enriched by this conversation, so we'll be back in a moment. Again, you've been listening to the Waters and Harvey Show. Marcus and I want to thank you all for tuning in and listening to this important conversation about the YWCA and its 110th anniversary and some of the projects that they've had going on.
Yeah, and one of the things that struck me about the conversation was just the scope of the advocacy work that the YWCA does, right? So everything's from women's issues to policing policies to access to swimming for children of color. So this is an organization whose advocacy scope is considerable.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, as a historian, it's important for people to know their stories and to know their history. And the YWCA is doing a lot to make that available to people. And the work that Sarah is doing in her own research, I think, is so important. And I hope that people will take the opportunity to go out and look up her work and read her work, because it gives so much insight on the uniqueness of the experience here in Asheville and Western North Carolina.
Yeah, and especially because, as we've noted on this show before, the social history of our country is a history that unfortunately suppresses the stories of significant populations within our nation. So it's important that more historians take the method of oral history seriously as a way of sort of giving voice to these suppressed stories.
So a good way to end this conversation, Marcus, and thank you for that. And Marcus and I want to remind you that the Waters and Harvest Show is produced at Blue Ridge Public Radio in Asheville, North Carolina.
And you can listen to our podcast on BPR.org, on the BPR mobile app, and on iTunes and Google Play.
Follow us and get in touch on Facebook and Twitter, and we will talk to you next time.